talking to you guys was, can you make sure everyone leaves on an upbeat note? So it's a pretty tall order, really. But anyway, I'll do my best for you, I promise you. I'm not going to get into any complex data because I'm not a scientist. And I have to be honest with you, I tend to believe... in simplicity. I think sometimes we get bogged down in minutiae, and it's often done, and it tends to befuddle politics quite a lot. So I'm really going to try and keep things quite simple, and some things, quite frankly, are so unbelievably obvious that it frustrates me as someone who believes in the socialist cause that it is such an uphill and difficult struggle when one talks to people and engages with them. It is such a difficult struggle to, if you like, get them to sort of go along with you because they are so entrenched in the system as it currently is. So one of the things it comes back to, I think, what Paddy was saying. I mean, you know, Bill, Paddy and Stephen all gave fantastic talks. Something Paddy was saying is that one thing that is immensely frustrating, I think, for us, and this, of course, people always say, you know, well, how are you going to get to this utopia? And first thing that leaps into my mind was, unless I've got a complete misunderstanding of what utopia is, I'm actually quite keen to get to something that is a utopia. But people tend to sort of knock it back as if to say, well, it's utopia. And I always have thought, well, what's wrong with that? But they will argue for capitalism until the cows come home very often. So therein, I'll try and sort of look at some of that stuff. But as Paddy was saying, it is terribly disappointing sometimes to be in a group like this and look out of the window and see thousands of people marching by, you know, waving flags and looking at these polished cannons and everything. You know, for heaven's sake, it is bloody hard, to be honest. So to leave on a high note, I'm going to have to work pretty hard, but I'll do my best. Coming back to just briefly, and one of the things I didn't want to sort of waste time on other people's time, really. But I must say, you know, with all the talk of Greta Thunberg, I mean, I don't know a great deal about her. I obviously, as much as you guys have, I suppose I've read up and Googled her and all the rest of it and seen her talking. But I do tend to think, I remember what I was like at 16 and, you know, an absolute egotistic, horrible little git, basically. And I mean, if I'd been doing at least a bit of what she's doing, I'd be quite happy, to be honest with you. Can I just ask you all, who here, I don't want to sound like a teacher at the beginning of the lesson, but who here is actually a member of the S... Well, let's put it this way. Could you just put your hand up if you're not a member of the SPGB? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. That's 5. Out of those 5, who is this the first experience of listening to a talk by socialists?
Well, I've listened to Danny a lot.
Okay, so... well, actually, okay. So actually... is that a tough life for you, really? But, okay, so there's one lady at the back. Karen, isn't it? So, right, so can you see this is what I'm getting at here? In a way, we should, all of us here, who, I guess, pretty much... It feels good to share the ideas with people you talk to, but actually, there's only one person here that hasn't kind of experienced this before, so we're focused on you, Karen. And even if you can go away and think, well, actually, 90% of what they're saying makes sense, that would be really helpful. OK, so I thought that would be the case, unfortunately, but rather disappointing. Never mind, not that you're disappointing, Karen, I have to add there. Right, what I was saying about the simplicity of stuff, what I mean is that if when one is talking to other people, and this is where we've got to kind of look, be upbeat here, because what we want is change, and we want is change for the better. So when you're talking to other people, you kind of want them to feel that enthusiasm, that, yeah, do you know what, if that happened, it would be wonderful. So one thing I tend to think of, and you can kind of slot this into conversations, is that although people, you know, you get them to the point where you think, oh yeah, they're going to, I think they're getting this, you know, social, yeah, I think they're getting it. And then they say, well, you get to that point and they say, well, help people buy something. And you think, oh, I know, you suddenly realise they haven't quite got it. But money in itself, as an item, as a thing, There's nothing we do in the world that needs the existence of money, and that's one thing you can sometimes chat to people about. And, you know, because you know you can make furniture, you can grow things in the land, you can study, you can cure people, you can do what I used to do and climb around in trees and prune trees. You can do all these things. You know, you can be a lecturer, you can be a scientist, you can be giving people information, you can be a nurse, you can be a doctor. All that stuff can be done. You don't actually need, in a world society, the physical presence of money. Now, what people will tend to do when you talk about that is they say, oh, well, what are you suggesting we do? Live in yurts or go back to caves and wear furs? They always say that sort of stuff. But you have to kind of, I think, extrapolate from that and take, well, actually, no, you don't mean that at all. We mean a step forward into a much, much better, happier society. And it is tricky because even my own wife believes in sort of incremental change. And, of course, We get terribly frustrated with that because, you know, incremental change is reformism by the very nature of the word, and sadly, it is hard work. So, these are a couple of prompts I put down, and the first one I thought, why did I put that? So really, it's a new society, so we're on the verge of something that's looking pretty dismal. Arguably, we've always been on the verge of certain things like that, as someone mentioned earlier, nuclear war and so on. But this is, and I've personally met scientists who told me this in person, that this is really, really happening, this sort of stuff. And it's not no longer an isolated thing, it is a world thing. So a new society could come out of all this, and it may be that this is the time for socialism to have its day. And a talk for another time, not now, but I very much agree with Paddy. Somehow the society, I think, or socialists, if you like, need to look at how this information is disseminated. And it may be the Extinction Rebellion would have to be invited along, and we hear them talk and share ideas, and they would, as far as they got down the line, think, oh, well, yeah, that would be the answer. I've actually said to a few of them, you know, there's already a party that exists you could vote for that will get everything you want and more. But they kind of said they don't kind of get that either, a great deal. I've mentioned the common denominator earlier in terms of it is always, in my view, money and profit. But if you listen to the news, and by and large, the problems in the world, whether we are listening to any questions, the Radio 4 news, or anything like that, they always tend to have this common denominator, and it is the economy, or money, or whatever it is, something like that, or the lack of money. It's always that. And so, therefore, if, as another way of explaining socialism to people, you kind of open them up to that idea, so we just listen to the news. What is that common denominator? And that alone can help people think, well, yeah, actually, he's right or she's right, and so on. I put socialism in, as a name. Now, I have to say, speaking in this group, I don't want to... I'm acutely aware of, you know, we have to... All of you here, with the exception maybe of Karen, may not understand socialism as it really is. And I think this is a major problem, not for us necessarily, but if you're trying to convey a better world to people and you use the word socialism, some people think of Tony Blair, some people think of Hitler's National Socialist Party, some people think of, you know, Jeremy Corbyn or the Socialist Workers' Party. So there is a problem there. Now, I'm not saying I'm on a banner, on a soapbox trying to get it changed, but for another time, I think it's something that he's thinking about, because really, if it's associated with a left and right wall of politics, it's a slight problem, because the other thing people always say is Russia, of course, they use, or China, or whatever. And these are big problems to get over before you've even engaged them with the idea of a better future, because they think you're talking about something that has already existed. Therein lies a massive problem. So I'm not going to get onto that now, but it is a personal thing that I'm worried about, because people think, oh, do you mean... what, Russia or something? They don't quite get it, and I don't want to labour that now, to be honest with you, because I think it's not the time and place for that. The last point I made here is that when one is talking about all this, you're talking about change, so you have to talk to people about that, and it's astonishing how people will defend, they will admit, and as Stephen said, that... in his talk, there was Frederick Jameson had already said, you know, most people can conceive of the entire breakdown of society before they can conceive of change. So that in itself is a barrier one has to get across when discussing socialism. That really is a problem. And they will defend it to the hilt. It is quite astonishing how aggressive people get when you're chatting to them in those areas. So let's talk about good things. Beauty. I can't remember who it was. It could have been Bill or Paddy. But it was talk about an allusion to this in their talks. This is something that capitalism struggles with because it can't put an economic value on it. So therein lies a problem. So that's why you get, you know, things that we perceive as beautiful being trashed. And that's happening in the environment. But in a socialist society, that wouldn't need to happen. You wouldn't have to wipe out half a dozen ancient woodlands just to get to Birmingham 20 minutes quicker, because there'd be no need to do that. No one would want to do that. So I'll come on to that a bit more later. So beauty is the very thing that makes us feel good. I mean, this is just a snap in a roadside verge that I took, you know, and to me, that is beauty. It's a beautiful thing. And as has also been mentioned, funny enough, coming to my notes here, Rachel Carson, of course, wrote Silent Spring and in defence of these dreadful huge corporations that were chucking herbicides and pesticides at road verges and so on. And what wasn't mentioned, or it was clearly alluded to, was that Monsanto, that company that still exists now, of course, did their complete utmost best to destroy that lady. Ironically and very sadly, she died a few years after writing that book of cancer, which was pretty atrocious. So these things come second in capitalism. So actual beauty comes second. Now, another, you know, I've just put a few snaps in here, but I mean, again, the butterflies are on the decline. Now, in a socialist society, an organism or species or an animal like this would be valued alongside everything else. It wouldn't be thought of as a secondary thing that is one is happy to destroy to put a factory if that factory wasn't needed, or to just to get somewhere quicker. All these things would be considered in a socialist society in a way that was for the benefit of not just all people, but the future and for species with which we share the planet. And of course, in capitalism, it's so obvious that these things are happening in very simplistic ways. So, for example, I went to a lecture of the Wildlife Trust given by a chap who had worked in Africa. I believe that's where the white rhino, the last remaining one or two, are. And they were trying to save these white rhinoceroses. And he was working tirelessly to save literally the last few. And what was happening were poachers were going in and cutting their horns off. So they stun them or shoot them, then cut their horns off and sell them in Vietnam as aphrodisiacs or something. So if you think about it, in a socialist society with no money, no need for profit, no one would do that. Who would want to travel halfway across the world into a very dangerous jungle or dangerous area to kill a very dangerous animal, cut off its horn? What would you do with it? So, in a way, lots of things are happening in capitalism that just wouldn't happen without money. And again, this is so obvious to me, but it's frustrating that it's not thought of more by most people you try and share these ideas with. When I was a kid in here, and I think some of you might be even as old as I am here, so you probably remember on the television, and indeed in general, the food mountains and all that sort of stuff. And I remember even as a young boy seeing these, and there was a massive picture on, well, a small television, but a massive pile of cauliflower on the television. I remember looking at this, and they were talking about it, and what they were saying was, well, we couldn't sell this cauliflower, so we just had to heap it up by the fields, but we found people were coming along and helping themselves to a cauliflower, and so we had to spray it with kerosene, otherwise they would have had it all for nothing. And that was when I think it really first hit me how bloody stupid things are. And of course we all know, and I don't have to go on about it, we all know that fishermen throw back fish that are too small, so they're killing fish just to sell bigger fish and so on. Anyway, let's keep on the good news. Okay. When I was years ago, I was canoeing down a river, the Mackenzie in Canada. It was about 1,000 miles, and coming near the end, I took this picture and thought how beautiful it looked. It was what the Americans call the cottonwoods, I think. So they're poplars in our language, and it was just reflected in the river. I mean, it wasn't all like that. It's much harder, of course. But we were cruising down the river, and I took this picture, which I thought was rather lovely. And later, I was involved in interviewing some of the scientists and the elders in the Inuit communities at the mouth of this river, at a place called Inuvik. And they were telling me that, you know, the hunters and the people that lived, if you like, traditional lives had spent within these areas... had a very, very close relationship with the land, but they were now, there was talk about crashing a pipeline through all this lot, and indeed that sort of thing could be happening anywhere in Canada. This happens to be a particular place. But the big issue over there was the jobs versus the environment. So people saw that you'd have 50% of native people wanting to sort of keep their way of life and have this relationship with nature, whereas others, even in the same community, said, oh yeah, but we get jobs out of this. So it was interesting because this need to work, this obligation that people have to sell themselves for an income is so powerful in this society that it almost always trumps the environment and indeed people. Okay, let's just talk a bit about people here. It's often said that people are inherently selfish. You know, they're nasty, acquisitive, and everything else. Now, be very, very careful with that one, because I had a long conversation with a chap who is a real Thatcherite, and he's actually a husband of a friend of my wife's. And we were walking along together. There's quite a group of us. We sort of got off into pairs, and we were just chatting. And he was trashing my ideas, basically saying, oh, people are naturally dreadful. How on earth can you expect some society like that ever to come into existence? Blah, blah, blah. So he's going on like that. And then right at the end of all this, I said, oh, I've got carried on. I realised I was on a bit of a losing wicket, but I said, oh, yeah, what are you up to this weekend? He said, oh, well, every weekend I go and volunteer for this charity and I do this and I do that. And I said, okay, so you have just told me that everyone is inherently selfish. And I have to say, I felt pretty good because he realised he shot himself in the foot there and his argument fell apart quite quickly. But anyway, people, so these are the crusties we're talking about to some extent, and the Extinction Rebellion have come up an awful lot today. Amongst the speakers. And this is interesting because they do get such a lot of publicity, and there's a lot of people that want to slag them off. And of course, the demographic's interesting, isn't it? Because the people that are going there, let's face it, predominantly white people, I would say. I don't know if you'd agree. I think they probably are. They are often young, students, self-employed people, older people retired, people with time on their hands, teachers, and that is the demographic. And it's interesting because people, the comments they get, I mean, whether you like them or not, they are really horrible, horrible, nasty comments on the internet. But the reality is, of course, that they have got time to be able to go and do that. Most people are wage slaves, quite simply. They have the idea that they could go in a factory, sell to their line man and say, oh, I'm just off for 2 weeks to go down to London camping. No way. They'd lose their jobs. Their families would be in trouble. So actually, capitalism holds people down very, very well, actually, in that respect. So of course they're going to look like sort of either, you know, hemp-smelling crusties or middle-class white people, because that's the sort of people that can do it. If you believe in middle class, that is. Anyway, I was quite intrigued when Extinction Rebellion first came about, because I came across them. I was at a meeting in... it wasn't really a meeting. I was showing some work of mine in down in Wales, and I came across XR for the first time then. And I've since been to 5 meetings, and my main interest was to find out what they meant by system change, because that is their strap line, system change, not climate change. And I have to be honest with you, not one of them, not one, and I've asked lots of people when I was at those meetings, I was being a bit of a nuisance really, because I was asking, and they couldn't vocalise what they actually meant. the only thing they were trotting out was what they'd read on their own website, but none of them could say, well, it's this, this or this, you know, that we want to change society in its entirety. None of them were saying that. They seemed to think that by getting an appointment with Michael Gove with half a dozen people, that everything was going to be hunky-dory. Now, you know, we all agree, and that is just, you know, the idea of changing this government is, to me, is delusional, really. And the other thing, which was also off on a bit of a sideline, but some of you have probably seen the video of the chap that climbed up onto the underground train and got yanked off and crashed down on the ground, and then later in that video it shows this an old elderly man with his hand, quite quiet he was, his hand glued to the train, and there's a bit of dialogue going on, and there's this guy who's saying, you know, look, I've got to get on the train, I've got to get to work, without realising the irony of that. You know, that is the point, he's got to get to work. He's not someone who can, if you like, make his own decisions. He's got to get to work, otherwise he'd probably be fired. And that's why people are so angry about not getting to work. They're not actually thinking slightly beyond that, which I thought was a bit telling, really. I'm afraid I've chucked a few Arctic pictures in here because, as I said earlier, one draws on one's own experiences, and that's how you, if you like, formulate your ideas in life. This little settlement here is called Bathurst Inlet, and I travelled there by kayak a few years ago now, as you can probably guess by the way I look now. The reason I mention this is because of this idea that people are inherently dreadful. We had been probably kayaking about 16 hours, and we arrived at this little settlement probably at 2 o'clock in the morning, I would say it was. Very dim Arctic light. And as we kayaked in, we could see a few lights on in the distance and these few little huts where the Inuit people lived in this place, Bathurst Inlet. Now, before we got out of the water, and there were four of us, we came in and someone came down to meet us with two hot flasks of coffee. They invited us into their cabins, and they sat us down. They made us we had a muskox and caribou stew, and they'd made bannock, and they were talking to us, and a few more people came out of different huts, sat down, got us all warm, made sure we were all happy. Now, the point I'm making is, I suspect that probably wouldn't happen in Sevenoaks, but the thing is, these people, the reason that they display, A, that they are, people are nice, and in these the hunter-gatherer communities, they have to share. So it's a mini microcosm of socialism, if you like. They're sharing, they're looking after each other. Okay, albeit a tiny, tiny, not a worldwide community, but it's tiny. But that very much comes out, and I've experienced it an awful lot, particularly in the Arctic. Now, but I can add to that, because later in these people are, if you like, hunters. I mean, that's actually what they do for their food, they hunt. So when they're in that little community, they had a sort of sense of pride and a sort of self-worth that was palpable. We saw one or two of them later in a much bigger settlement, because they don't stay here all year round, and they were changed people. They're kind of moping around the town, looking just no self-esteem, you know, and it's so different. Now, I guess the point I'm making here is that when people are part of a society, not a worthless cog on a production line, if you like, I know that sounds a bit arcane, but actually that's what most of us are when you're involved in wage labour, you have no real feeling of belonging or being part of decision-making or part of society. So why socialism would be so good is that everyone would be bringing their skills, whatever they are, to a much bigger picture, and they would have ownership of that. They feel part of it. It's very much like the old crafts in the villages years ago, where the blacksmith was a respected person in the community. That person, would be using his skills, he'd be respected and feel good about himself. That's one hell of a lot of difference from working in a factory, clocking in, screwing a plastic hand to a broom, putting it there, screwing another one in. I know that's an exaggeration, but by and large, that's what's happening now. There's no human input that means that they're feeling a real part of the good of society, because actually, they're not. They're worthless. They are just making stuff for the few. To quote Corbyn. So I'm mentioning all that. And the other thing to think about, the great thing about socialism, is that At the moment, I read statistics that suggest that 60% of employed people are involved only in financial work. So there'd be bankers, insurance people, or people at tills, people taking money, accountants. And if you think about it, 60% is an awful lot. So that would free up an awful lot of time because there'd be no money. There would be no transactions. You know, people would reasonably ask and have what was due to them. And that wouldn't... So therefore, in a good socialism, you wouldn't have children dying through lack of food because it would equally be shared out. And the raison d'etre of the whole world society would be to make sure that there weren't people like that. And that would, so therefore, it would all be so much better. One more thing I must mention on that lady in the middle with the black and grey parka, she had an illness, and it meant that she had to occasionally be flown to Edmonton for treatment. Now, you think, well, what's wrong with that? The Canadian government hate that. They hate these people that are sort of slightly nomadic because they... It costs them a fortune to take that lady to hospital. So they really make their life hard. They want them to be in settlements so they can keep an eye on them. But they are extremely happy to ship this stuff all over the Arctic. And the weight of that is a bloody sight more than that old lady, I can tell you. And the middleman in that, because it's all processed crap. And, you know, the middleman makes a small fortune out of that. Anyway, I won't go to Arctic health right now. But I was talking to someone this morning, and it suddenly occurred to me, my wife and I were on holiday, well, I say holiday, we had a weekend, I was saying Stephen, who was from Portsmouth, we were down in Portsmouth for a couple of days, a couple of weeks ago, and it suddenly occurred to me that Petersfield, I don't know if any of you know it, on the South Downs, is full of charity shops, and my wife was saying, blimey, this stuff in here is amazing, it's all sort of designer, posh stuff and everything, and of course it's gone a funny sort of way now, all this, because people just have so much stuff and they're encouraged to buy so much stuff that they go, I've got too much of it, chuck it at the charity shop. So this is what's going on. And I spoke to a little a lovely old lady who had a bookshop. She said, oh God, it's so hard. We can barely survive in our bookshop because we're competing at the Oxfam bookshop who have free books, free labour and pay no rates. So it's a weird thing, the charity shop thing. But where I was going with that, you know, the capitalism now got to the point where it's producing so much stuff that they have to use little adverts like this, which is in the dreaded Lakeside or wherever it is, near the Dartford Tunnel somewhere. So that actually says for anyone who can't see it from there, find someone for something who has everything. You know, doesn't that drive you mad when you see that sort of thing, in my view? But capitalism is very, very powerful. And at the end of the day, we want a better society. We want a society where we don't feel that we have to buy something if we've already got everything. So it is a mad society. And an example I could give you of that is when I heard that, well, John Humphreys has finished Radio 4 now, I think, but a while back there was all that talk about bringing people across the Mediterranean. And basically, these were people traffickers, if you like. And hundreds, as we know, of people were just cramming in ships and they were sinking and dying in the Mediterranean. Now, people were facilitating that and making that happen. They were taking their money from their families or them, putting them on highly dangerous boats and basically hoping, well, not hoping, that they may or may not make it to the other side. But it was interesting because this is just a very quick thing, but they were being referred to on the radio by Humphreys and others as businessmen. And I'm talking about the traffickers, not the people that were dying here. And that shows, it sort of said to me something. It's, if you're involved in making money, something sometimes anything is legitimised if you're making money and profit out of it. So the fact that you're killing people, he's still a businessman, you know. And I thought, it was just astonishing. This is another thing to which will show you, if you like, an example of something that will absolutely not happen in what I see as a utopian socialism. These are UGG boots. I don't own a pair myself, but they were very fashionable, I gather, a year or so ago. And I only showed you this picture because I wondered if you could tell the difference between these UGG boots and these UGG boots. Well, actually, I don't know if there is a difference, but one's real UGG boots and the other one's a sort of counterfeit. And I only put this in because it was so amusing, because there was a whole shitload of these counterfeits came in, and to me they were pretty similar. But they had to all be destroyed and burnt because they weren't real UGG boots, and someone had a sort of, you know, copyright or whatever it is, not copyright, you know, patent on the real UGG boots. And this poor woman was on the way saying, oh, there's some orders, some UGG boots for my daughter, and they didn't arrive, and I was told they'd had to be destroyed. And so not only did this poor woman saved up for her daughter and paid for the UGG boots, they were burnt anyway because they weren't real UGG boots. I mean, this would not happen in socialism, basically. And nor would you get built-in obsolescence, so you wouldn't get a sort of pen. Well, it's a nice pen, you know. This thing doesn't work, chuck it away. But built-in obsolescence wouldn't happen. You know, everything, and there may be things that would come to the end of their life, but by and large, things that will be made for use, and they'd be beautifully designed, the best designs possible. And I hope this doesn't sound pie in the sky. There's no reason it shouldn't be like that. The only reason it's not like that now is because, you know, capitalists want to sell more of the stuff. They don't want to have something good that lasts forever. So all these things will come naturally. Now, the other great crutch of capitalism is, charities. And I often think to myself about this, and I think, I've said on a lot of talks, I give quite a lot of talks to wildlife trusts for some reason, but I kind of don't talk pure socialism, but I do kind of worm around the whole idea, so I leave them going away thinking and questioning things. But if you think about it, how can you possibly call a society civilised if it needs charities in the first place? I mean, that alone for me is an argument. You know, but if you think what charities actually do, they very successfully support capitalism. That's why you see them, you know, the old sort of politicians sort of smoothing up to one charity or another, but they don't work, basically. And I've got a lot of sympathy, and I think what they do demonstrate is actually that people aren't, generally speaking, selfish. They are very good, and I know a number of people who tirelessly work for charities, and that proves to me that people are inherently good. And I think that it's a very important thing. If you look at the bad side of people, in socialism, I would suggest 99% of what we perceive as the bad side of people wouldn't be there, because they're only like that because capitalism either brainwashes them or forces them into being in a position. They have to be like that, if you like. If they were in a society that was generally caring, who'd want to be the person that didn't care? You know, it would be an infectious thing. So we must bear that in mind. On the side of the environment, very quickly, this is an interesting thing I came across. I don't know if any of you have ever seen a film that was produced. I saw it at the Hay Festival. It was called The End of the Line. It's basically about fishing, but this guy gives a very clear picture of what's going on in the world's oceans. And one of the things he said was Mitsubishi, and I had no idea of this. I thought Mitsubishi just made old trucks and stuff like that. But apparently they don't. They're a massive corporation. And they are currently buying up bluefish tuna, knowing that it's going to go extinct, and they're freezing it so that when it goes extinct, they make vast amounts of money out of it. So that is another madness of capitalism. Instead of this beautiful animal being allowed to carry on, and, you know, people will see it, know it's in the... Just knowing that that animal's in the sea is good enough for them. But, you know, they're killing... They're buying these things and freezing them, hoping the bloody... You know, they're going to go extinct. It's utterly mad. So, this is the important thing for all of us. We've got Karen here, and we're outnumbering her by quite a few, and it would be nice if Karen goes back and goes, I completely get that. that's what I want to be, a socialist. Anyway, so change. So this is, to me, is massively important, because when you talk to people, you're effectively kind of hoping they're going to change the way they think. Now, you can talk about socialism, you can try and illustrate some of the awful things that are going on, and you can hope that they come round to another way of thinking. The problem is, what you can't do is be patronising, because people hate that. You can't be doom-mongering, because people hate that. It's a real hard, bloody thing to do, to be honest. But one thing I'd like to just share with you, and I haven't got any particular deep knowledge of this, but my daughter, and one is all, you know, one's always proud of one's own children, but she's worked extremely hard. She's a doctor now, and she's just becoming a consultant psychiatrist after vast innings of training. And her boyfriend is also a psychiatrist, so heaven knows what their life's like together. But anyway, they seem to be getting on okay. But they came over the other day, and they were saying something quite interesting to me. And they were saying that sometimes patients present themselves to them, and they basically analyse the position the patient's in. It's generally, it's always a mental issue, obviously, as a psychiatrist. But there are many times they've told me that they can help this person and, if you like, cure the person. But, and this is very interesting, and I hope I explain this to you as well as she explained it to me, but I'll try and keep it simple. But basically, if that person presents themselves at the age of 35, 40, 45, whatever it is, 50, and they are told that the condition they had for virtually their whole life can be cured, and they can get rid of it and lead a normal life, then a lot of the time they react against that. They don't actually want that to be the case. And the reason is, according to my daughter, is that they've, all that time in their life, they've identified with being what they were. So they were Fred, the schizophrenic, or the alcoholic, or whatever it was. Actually, that's become so linked into their psyche that suddenly all that would count for nothing, even though it might be being an alcoholic or schizophrenic or whatever it is. Now, what that said to me is that does create a pretty big issue if you're trying to get people round to thinking of socialism. Because everything they've been up to that point in their lives, and I began to think about myself in this as well, would not necessarily count for nothing, but your, all the things that you held as your values and your truths and what you stood by, and that could be Corbyn, Thatcher, you know, building a company up, buying this house that you think is so good, and your widescreen TV, it'd all be meaningless. You'd have to then start from scratch. Now that is a, I'm not going to dwell on it now, but it's actually worth thinking about that. It's a very big thing to ask people. So it might be worth engaging people in conversation about socialism with the opening gambit of talking about that sort of thing, saying, well, what have you done in your lives? Without mentioning politics, you know, do you value that? Would you see other things as being a happier way of living and so on? But the reason I mentioned that, it struck me as very interesting. Incidentally, wait, I'm coming to the end now, you'll be pleased to know. This is another Arctic shot, and I took this up in northern Canada on the tundra somewhere. But it's a fire pit, basically, and you come across them occasionally. This one was probably hundreds of miles from the nearest town, if you like. And what it shows is that, you know, life is not just about us now. People have lived, eaten together, loved each other, spent time together thousands of years before we have. And this just shows an example of a meal that was probably shared amongst a group of people together, and sharing the meal. Hunters tend to share, and they would have moved on. And there's a bit of evidence that that brief moment in time is written into that land for eternity almost. But the reason I kind of put this in, I've got a friend called Catherine Wickham-Jones. I say a friend, I haven't seen her for a while. She lives up in Orkney, and she wrote a book called Fear of Farming. And she's an expert, I suppose you'd call her an anthropologist, but she deals with things like scarab brain, the excavations of the places in Orkney. And an interesting point she made in her book, and to me, was that when, if you like, the Paleolithic hunter-gatherer people changed to Neolithic, so they became essentially farming agrarian communities, that did not happen over hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years. It happened within a couple of generations. So it was incredibly quick. Now that struck me as interesting, because socialism could be something that happens quickly. Somebody said about tomorrow, and they doubt if it would happen tomorrow. Well, of course not. But actually, I think if enough people saw, it's not a question of them a revolution in the terms of XR or rebellion. It's a question of quite simply understanding in your head what is currently wrong. That's enough. You don't need to rebel, actually, because if enough people understood it, it would happen by default. But that is where we've got to get to. But I think it could happen actually very, very quickly indeed if enough people thought about it. So the message is, how do you get those people to think about it? Okay, just to finish, I did put a quote in here, but I've forgotten what the quote was because I didn't stupidly type it in. But actually, what it was, one of the Apollo 17 astronauts, and I'm going to get the quote wrong because I won't remember it, obviously. When those people went to the moon, if you can imagine in the 70s and so on, when they were walking on what was effectively another planet, and they were looking back at the Earth, and I think it was Colonel Vaughan who said this, but he said something like, in our paucity of wisdom and paucity of wisdom and something else, we come close to the brink of destroying the world as we know it. And the only solution is a global change of consciousness. So forgive me for not getting that, I'm paraphrasing the quote, but he was looking back, he was seeing what that fragile thing hovering around there, and after all, at the moment, as far as we know, we as human beings are custodians of all the known life in the universe. So that's how it is, how it looked to him. The fragility of that Earth was such that he said, we come close to the brink of destruction, and the only solution, in his words, is a global change of consciousness. And I would say that's our answer, really. It's having everyone has to think that actually we've got to go forward. I don't think we need left or right politics. That sounds like a wall to me, left or right. It's something over the top we've got to get to. Anyway, thank you. I think
can I just mention something? I think it's important when anyone comes into a socialist meeting or to head office and whatever, is not to start talking to them about socialism, it's about asking about themselves. What brought you here? What are you interested in? Get some awareness of them before you start hammering the socialism. Because I think sometimes you can put them off by your sheer determinism to thrust socialism on them. Sometimes you need something a bit more easier. Come and tell us what you're doing, where you're living, what's that, and take your graduate. And take an interest in them sometimes creates the right environment. The right sort of situation here.
I completely agree with that, actually. I completely agree with that. I don't know if that was my job to do that, Carl. But anyway, if I didn't count, I'm really sorry about that.
It's all right. What's that butterfly, the large blue butterfly?
Common blue.
Yeah, the large blue one, I've done some paintings of endangered butterflies. And went into it quite deeply, and I was quite shocked that in its early stages, it's taken inside red ants' nests.
Yeah.
And they lick it for a year.
They nurture its the grubs, don't they?
They found out that it secretes a sweet substance. Mm. And to them, it's like honey, so they lick it and they keep it warm and apart from it. Then, at a certain point, this sticky stuff stops coming, they throw it out, and it turns into a large blue butterfly, which is quite similar to that.
It's a small socialism community, you see.
Everything in nature is interlinked.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a kid, I think nothing of stamping on a red ant is big. Red ants, yes, you know, red ants are bad, black ants are good, you know, anything as a child. But now you think that everything is interlinked in nature. The other point I'd like to make in nature, let's not think that nature is lovely. I know you said you're looking at those trees and all that, it looks beautiful with the reflection. But let's look at nature. Everything in nature wants to kill everything else.
Red includes tooth and claw.
We're all in the food chain, and there's a pandemic with our name on it coming.
To use.
So we do need.
You're not helping my uplifting stuff. You just sort of. I'd rather you said a slight cold there. But
on a more positive note, I think what's really interesting is your explanation about nature and how we can go better. But I think that systemic change can happen, and it's all it takes. I think it's from the University of Oxford or Cambridge, they said it only takes about 6 to 6.5% of the population, and it can make a change in a political system, if those are active.
I think it's what Roger Hallam says as well, isn't it?
Yes. 5%.
But the point is, I think that if people are interested and put the time in to think about it and do it, it can be made with change. Of course, that doesn't count for other thing factors as well, but I think if that can be done, you can bring about a socialist, you know, change very quickly. And also add it to climate change. But I think that's it's been interesting about what you're talking about how we can change very quickly.
There lies the problem.
Yeah. Just to say about the picture at the end there, that lovely view of the Earth. In that picture, the Earth was clearly flat.
Oh, what?
We're all here as well, aren't we?
I thought it looked a bit bent, actually. I think they want to go, don't you?
Can we just thank the North London for putting on this fantastic event?
Yes. I'd like to thank all four speakers for a brilliant day. Thank you very much.